And while we're waiting, I'll take the opportunity to introduce the visiting monks who are here. On my right is Venerable Dhamma Jiwa. He's from Mitragala Monastery over in Sri Lanka. He's teaching us non-residential retreat the next couple of days here. And on my left is Venerable Dhamma Wasa from Brisbane. He's a fellow Aussie. Very nice, Mike. I've known him for many years. And he's also got a temple just outside of Colombo. It's been Apichato, one of my babies, because I ordained him. So, but he's a big baby now, so he's a teacher in his own right. Ajahn Apichato, 13 years now as a monk. 13 reigns, yes. And of course we have Bhikkhuni Satima over there, a real, live, fully ordained Bhikkhuni. And we have Sister Naroda and Sister Mudita over there from Dhammasara Monastery. So it's a special occasion this evening, just you've got so much power facing you. So you should have got a very good meditation this evening. But the talk this evening, now everyone is settled down, I wanted to give a talk about one of the things about Buddhism which I was really inspired with when I was very young, and that is just that you could question anything in this religion. And it was a way of investigation. You can ask questions, you can dig deep and find out what's really happening. And because of that openness, it meant that you could follow inquiring. It wasn't just because that was a nice thing to be able to do. That was like essential to the Buddha's teachings. And when you started reading those Buddhist teachings, first of all, you could read them. And you could take those teachings which you read and go to your favorite monk or nun and argue with them, which is a wonderful thing to be able to do, to argue with people. And so even with Ajahn Chah, this great monk, you could go there and argue for half an hour, an hour, and you'll never get upset. I remember this one lady from England, she came to argue with Ajahn Chah for a couple of hours. People said, come on, leave him alone, he's old. And he said, no, no. He said, you're just helping me sharpen my knife. And that's actually how he would regard when you ask difficult questions. Always it was accepted. And not just accepted for his own personal benefit, but accepted because this was almost sacred to Buddhism, if anything is sacred, the way of investigation, questioning, digging deep, finding out what's going on. And I think it's because of that, because this is almost a dogma, that there is no dogma, that it's almost essential that you are allowed to question, that Buddhism has thrived so much. And it's always been able to adapt by keeping the core teachings as a way of investigation, as a way of looking very deep and developing the abilities of the mind, like mindfulness, like peace, like calm, like this looking inside of things deeply, for many, many hours, because it developed these things, we came up, you know, with lots of nice ideas, and those ideas do develop over the centuries. Buddhism does evolve. And it's evolving here over in Australia, and that's why that we're going to have Santa Claus this evening. It's evolving, and why not? As we can very easily adapt to the cultures which we are in without sacrificing anything of the heart of the Buddha's teachings. We investigate these things and ask why. And that part of investigation means, it gives me a hard time, I must admit, because people are always asking me questions, you have to defend yourself, which is great though, because that should be open to ask those questions. But it also gives people a lot more confidence that this teachings which we have here is not brainwashing, it's not a cult, because the last thing which a cult will allow you to do is ask the difficult questions. Nothing is sacrosanct here except your freedom to ask those questions. And when we can't investigate like this, we come up with some really, really interesting ideas. But with investigation, sometimes it's not just enough to keep asking those questions, because sometimes we do need to have experience and data. That's why sometimes people question you about being a monk. Why are you a monk? It's stupid being a monk. You're just afraid of relationships, aren't you, Ajahn Brahm? Now, of course, it's easy to say that, but you should investigate. And a lot of times, the only way you'll know what it feels like to be a monk or be a nun is go and ordain, to get some experience, first of all. Because it's only when you, and sometimes we do have these opportunities, maybe not over here in Perth because we never got enough infrastructure, but in some places you can have temporary ordination, become a monk for a short time or a nun for a short time. And sometimes they call it like novice ordinations. Now, one of the reasons why we don't allow novice ordinations over in Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine is because at this time of the year, many of you would love to dump your children at Bodhinyana Monastery for 3 weeks at a novice program. Well, you're going to have a nice time having a holiday. So, school holidays. So, but in some countries, you can go to these temporary ordinations and you get a feel what it's like to be a monk, what it's like to be a novice, or be a nun, or whatever it is. And that actually gives you some experience, like the inner experience of what it's like to be like a monk, to be a nun, you know, to sort of not have all these things, which you can have whenever you like. And so the investigation is not just asking the questions, it's getting experience as well. Of what it's like. Okay, you might not be able to become a monk or a nun, but at least you can actually join a meditation retreat for a few days or go and stay at some of the monasteries. And when you actually stay in a monastery or stay on a meditation retreat, especially if it's a residential one, you know, basically you're living like a monk or a nun for that time. You know, you're not eating in the afternoon, having the same things which we eat. And because of that, you get some inner experience of what it's like. So a lot of times people keep saying, wow, it must be really hard to be a monk. Say, no, it's not. I think it must be really hard to be a layperson. Have to worry about all those bills, to go to work on a Monday morning, or to have to worry about a husband, to look after a wife, to look after your kids. My goodness. You've done it once in this life. Next life, don't do it again. So, did I tell that story last week about, I think I did, about the, please tell me, the one story about the man who went to the Holy Land with his wife. Now, I think I must have told, I think I told that in the Armadale group last Tuesday. Well, it just shows you just now how experience and what real suffering really is. About this guy who went to, his wife was a Christian and always wanted to go to Israel to see the holy sites. And it's like Buddhists go on pilgrimages to India. Christians and Jews, they go on a pilgrimage to Israel. So his wife was pestering him again and again and again. She was a very difficult woman to live with. And so she pestered him again and again. So eventually he took her over to Israel for the for a holiday. And when she was over there, she died. And so after she died, the chaplain of the hospital, which was treating her, said, well, look, we can do the funeral here in Israel for only $500, but to send her back to Australia, it'd be about $5,000. And we'd have to pay for the funeral expenses also. What do you want? And he said, no, I think we'd better send her back to Australia. And the chaplain was quite surprised. Why are you wasting all that money? He said, oh, because I heard a few years ago in this country, somebody died and he resurrected after 3 days. I can't take that chance with my wife. So why are you laughing there? Because it must be true. So understanding things like that, so you can understand by experience what suffering is. So we do investigate. And when you actually investigate, you get a very deeper understanding of life. You don't think about it. Because sometimes when we think, we think that's investigation. But a lot of times our thinking is limited to our experience of life. And so how can we really know sort of what like cancer is like until we've had it? How can we really know what peace is like until we've experienced it? So a lot of times the investigation of Buddhism is not just a philosophy, just so you can sit around a coffee table and think and get good ideas. It's much better than that. It's giving these opportunities to have these amazing experiences in life. Where else in Perth can you go to like a retreat center, which is coming up soon, and stay there for free for, you know, 8 or 9 days and do nothing at all day? Very rare to get that opportunity to find out what it's like to do nothing. Now that is a really lovely experience to have, because all your life you've been doing something. And when you have tried to get a bit of a break, you've either been told off for being lazy, or you're just telling yourself off. It's called being guilty. Now, a good example of this, you know, current, this is the holiday season in a country like Australia. And it's Christmas time. Even though Christmas is not till next week, already the builders at the retreat center have all finished for another couple of weeks. Already, if you are going to work, people aren't taking the work seriously anymore. Except if you're a monk, we have to work 365 days a year, all our life. In fact, I often complain, the older I get, the harder I have to work. Because it's true, the more venerable you are, the more people want to invite you to give talks. So I know what my future's going to be. When I get to my 60s and I'll just be starting, 70s, then you reach, you know, getting up there, but you don't reach your peak until you're 80 as a monk. And that's when you really have to start work. So I really wanted to actually to try and have a meeting with Kevin Reynolds and start a proper union for monks. Because the pay is terrible, being a monk. However, my retirement plan is out of this world. But to be able to understand what it's like to be a monk, yes, you can get some idea of it when you go on a retreat or when you meditate. You can actually investigate why. And it's that ability to investigate and get the experience of these things is what you have the opportunity to do here. And now, if you haven't got sick and you want to know what pain is like, come on a meditation retreat and sit down still for 1 whole hour. And see what it's like in your knees and your whatever. But that's obviously not what we're really trying to do. But there are many, many things in life which investigation gives us the answer. Which is why often if you do have a pain or a sickness, sometimes as Buddhists, sometimes, oh yeah, we're a bit compassionate, we try and help you. But the real teaching is, what is it like when you're actually really sick? Or you say you've just been told, like, happens, you know, all the time, you know, at least people come and talk to me. They've just gone to see their doctor, they've got cancer. Or it's now terminal. The doctor said, no more treatment. Or no, somebody's just died of a heart attack. Or whatever. How does that feel? So instead of just saying, oh, isn't that terrible? I'm so sorry that you've got cancer. I never say that these days. If you ring me up and say, look, Ajahn Brahm, I've only got a couple of days to live, I say, oh, that's really cool. What a great opportunity to investigate. So, you know, if you don't get much sympathy from a monk. Instead, you get an opportunity to become wise, to investigate. What does it feel like when that happens to you? What does it do to your mind? Now, straight away, when you investigate, you can cut all this, you know, let's, you know, use a modern word, bullshit, about, oh, it's so sorry, it's so terrible. Why? What's wrong with dying? What's wrong with being sick? Investigation challenges everything. And that's one of those little stories, or little object lessons, which I've often done here. I won't go through it totally. Sometimes I ask people, anyone here who's never been sick? And there's not one person in this room, I guarantee, who's never had sickness. And say, if there was someone in this room who'd never been sick in their life, you'd be weird. Doctors will want to sort of investigate you because you'd be an anomaly. You'd be very, very odd. In fact, there'd be something unhuman about you if you've never been sick. So factually, it's normal to be sick. And it's actually wrong to be totally healthy. So why is it whenever we are sick, we say, doctor, there's something wrong with me. I'm sick. And you investigate, and if you're wise, you'll say, no, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. There's nothing wrong with being sick. Now, a few people, I've told that story quite a few times, and the doctors in Perth know this now, because people have told me they've gone to see their doctor, they've got a cancer, or they've got flu, or they've got something really wrong with them, or some illness, and they tell the doctor, there's something right with me, doctor. You know, I've got flu again. And they say, oh, you go to Nolamara. But when you sort of take off this idea, even this label, you investigate, you don't say it's wrong, because when it's wrong, with wrong, you feel you're guilty. You've done something bad. It's bad karma that you're sick. You deserve it. You're evil. And you have this whole emotional guilt trip whenever you're sick, if you say sickness is wrong. Not only that, but the healing professions think there's something wrong with being sick. And so they try their hardest to try and change you into their idea of being a healthy person. And if you go to a doctor, and they really sort of, it's like rejecting you for who you are. There's something wrong with you. You're sick. Now, I've often said to the healing professions, often, as a doctor, psychologist, psychiatrist, often you can't heal people. And in fact, even wanting to heal people, sometimes there's something which is very negative about that. So rejecting them. Especially when they can't be healed. It's as if the terminal cancer people are failures. I'm not getting better. I'm hopeless. Instead of that, I've told many healers never actually to make healing your priority. Make care your priority. You may not always be able to heal someone, but you can always care for them. That's especially in mental illness. Sometimes it's just too difficult to take a person who's mentally ill and to get rid of that voices in the head or that depression or that ODD or whatever else is there. But you can always care for people. And you see the difference there. Caring is actually accepting the person. It's creating a positive relationship to them. Where they don't think there's something wrong with them, something they've done bad. So if you can care for a person, then sometimes healing happens as a bonus, but it's not a necessity. We take all this idea of sickness being wrong, or death being bad. So that's why sometimes people say, you know, when you go and tell people that, you know, mother died, oh, I'm terribly sorry. What do you mean you're terribly sorry? You never even knew her. But we have these ideas of death being sad. Instead, as a Buddhist, we investigate everything and challenge it. What's so sad about death? It's only we make it sad. For a lot of people, they've had enough time on this planet, and they're very happy to go. So for some people, it should be a great celebration. Maybe when Mr. Bush goes. I shouldn't say things like this. But why is it that most of these times, when we have so these funeral services, people always cry so much? What are you sad for? Again, we all know we never cry for the person who's died. We always cry for ourselves. It's just our attachments. So as a Buddhist, we investigate this. We go deep. We just don't follow what other people do. It's not just some sort of ritual which people follow blindly. That's the last thing which the Buddha wanted. And that's almost like heresy for Buddhism, just following things blindly. We want to find out why, what's going on. And when we investigate deeply over there, we find the only reason why people cry is just attachments. They were stupid to begin with to think that that person is going to be there a long time. Even to think that that's their husband or their wife or their child or their parent, their mum and dad. can see when you say it's my mum. My means ownership. It's an attachment. Which is why, as a Buddhist, we should know that, is that really your mother? Maybe, you know, do a DNA test. I don't know. But that's not what I really meant. The ownership there, that's a person who's reared you. And they may have been your mother in this life, but who were they were in the past life? Their child, where did they come from? They've got a whole history. That's more than your child. And I've asked, I haven't had a baby myself in this life, except, you know, people are ordained. But mothers actually tell me, I investigate, when you give birth, that being which comes out of your womb, is that like a fresh person, something new? They say, no, it's a whole being there. It's something with a history. I remember this one lady, I have some really weird stories, which I collect. Now, after the baby was born, she was breastfeeding it. She was laying on her back, and the baby was breastfeeding. After the baby had enough, the baby just took its mouth away from the breast and sat on the mother's tummy in full lotus, hands like this, and meditated. Spooked the hell out of her. You know, it was a perfect meditation posture after eating. Where did it learn that? And obviously these babies, they've had a history before, so is it really your child? Or is it some being who's come into your life and you nurture for so many years? And then you have to, once you've finished nurturing them, then you have to let them go. Now we investigate, what is this attachment of being my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife? We know we're only with each other for a certain length of time. We investigate that. We know that. And when we accept that, we can find all these partings which happen in life, whether it's death, divorces, kids going overseas, daughters becoming nuns or whatever it is, we can actually understand, accept, embrace and be at peace with it, rather than always being so afraid of losing people and things. When we investigate these attachments, family attachments, we go deep into it, ask the question, is this really my son, my daughter? What do I mean by mine? Why am I so attached to this? We question. We loosen these bonds which cause all the suffering in the world. And then instead of just loving just, you know, one person or just one family, the whole world can be your family. You can have like compassion for everybody. That's why it's so nice being a monk. Now, you are all my brothers and sisters. We call that brothers and sisters in the Dhamma. It's much nicer having 1 million brothers and sisters, or how many, 2 billion, rather than just one or two, and treating everybody with equal kindness. The door of my heart is open to all beings unconditionally, rather than just one or two, or just some with preferences. Why can't you love someone else as much as you love your child or your parent? Why can't we have a more even sense of kindness? That's an interesting question. So when we do go to investigate, we get some interesting answers. When we do those interesting answers, you know, it actually expands sort of our spirituality, our understanding about the nature of life. So when we investigate these things, it's not just with the things of life. We can go deeper into the philosophies of what happens to you after you die. We can always question. And of course, we've got things like reincarnation. And a lot of times people question that. There was a couple of weeks ago, I was in New Zealand at one of these conferences, and one of the presenters, I love going to Buddhist conferences where the presenter's not a Buddhist. Because I listen to Buddhists all the time. So as a Buddhist monk, it's nice to actually listen to another angle. And this person, I really respected him. He was a professor, an ex-theologian. And the reason why I really respected him, because he was, I think, in the Presbyterian Church in New Zealand, and twice was accused of heresy, went to the Presbyterian Church court and got off twice. So anyone's accused of heresy is a good friend of mine. And the reason is because they are courageous enough to question. Like, an interesting thing. I know that a couple of the monks said, you're pushing it a bit far, Ajahn Brahm, but I said no. Because I was saying that the path of investigation can unearth some very interesting facts. Like, one of the questions which has come up in the conference was, can a Buddha, a real Buddha, you know, one of, not an enlightened being, but a Buddha, can a Buddha be a woman? Now, you ask some of the monks here, and they'll quote, in the scriptures it says, they say, we know what it says, but what does it mean? And that's actually, if it says there, is that really just bound just by that particular social context? Because there is one sutta, only one little place, where it says the Buddha is a man. Okay, but question, investigate, go deeper. We don't just believe, we're not fundamentalists, you know, not like sort of some other religions where it says, because it's written in a book, that has to be true. Even if it was said by the Buddha, what did the Buddha mean by that? What was actually the explanation, the context, the meaning? And so I went on there and said, look, all my investigations, it doesn't really care. It doesn't matter whether a Buddha is a man or a woman. But if a being was about to be reborn as a Buddha, what gender would it choose? It would obviously, it's just a practical consideration. It will choose that gender which it could fulfill its role, its purpose of spreading the teachings of the Dharma in the best possible way. If it was a patriarchal society, sure, you'd get reborn as a man, because you'd be able to get more credibility. But if you had a matriarchal society, we have had matriarchal societies, you know, in our history. If it was a matriarchal society, then the Buddha would be reborn as a woman, obviously. That's my idea. I've investigated. That's what I say. I might get in trouble, but you can take me to a heretical court. But Buddhism will actually accept your ability to differ, and you won't be excommunicated because of that, which is a wonderful thing. And even some of the monks said, Ajahn Brahm, you were really controversial in that conference. They say, wonderful, because what do you come to a conference for? Not just to hear what you already know, but to hear something new. And why do I say that? Because the whole purpose, if I had a society who gazed with a dominant people in the society, the Buddha might get reborn as a gay. Why not? And that could be even more controversial. But the whole point is, whatever vehicle would be the most useful would be the vehicle which was chosen. So when we use a path of investigation, we can actually take these teachings and go much deeper. So we're not superficial, just relying on what was said. Because even the Buddha, again and again, said, don't just rely on what's said, investigate, take it deeper, find out. But I know this fellow, he was quite a radical Presbyterian, but when it came to reincarnation, there's no way he could accept that idea. Like many people can't. Why? So when I first came to the West, and for me it was quite obvious that reincarnation happens. It was, you know, they got understanding of that. But what was really fascinating for me, what block do people have? Why can't they have an open mind on the subject? And so you investigate, you question, you go deep. What is the barrier to accepting reincarnation? And I think one of the big barriers is fear. Fear of having to come back again. You'd rather not believe in reincarnation. Simply because, you know, one life is enough suffering for you. You don't want another one. And that's almost like a denial of something you don't want to see. So you check that one out. But the point is, if you're going to ask that question, you investigate. You can't get to answer to such questions just by thinking. You do need experience. That's one of the reasons why Buddhism is scientific. And by scientific, I mean it goes on the data of experience, the data of this world. So one of the great experiences I had when I did science was just getting my brain expanded, you know, by such things like relativity theory or like quantum theory, because that was something which was totally illogical, or rather counterintuitive. Little things, like getting your head around the fact you can't travel faster than the speed of light. So you may have some star maybe about 5 light years from here. And you can't travel faster than the speed of light. But you can get to that star in 10 minutes. Counterintuitive. What do you mean? That's illogical. It's only illogical because you can't see the bigger picture. Yeah, you can get to that star in 10 minutes. You can come back again, but 20 years or 10 years have gone on Earth. The time changes when you start speeding up a bit. That's why a whole 2008 has gone so quickly, because you've been traveling close to the speed of light. Well, that's actually, there's a counterintuitive. You've got like things like quantum theory, the great Schrodinger's cat experiment, where the cat is neither alive nor dead. It's a third possibility. Then you can read about that on Google, on internet, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory, where you got, and it's real. This is what happens. This is reality. You've got a cat who's not alive, who's not dead, who's neither, which is interesting. I don't know what the cat feels about that. But what that really did is showed me just the limits of my rational mind. I just did not have enough evidence, enough raw experience and data. So what Buddhism also wants you to do is to think, but to think courageously, to be willing to abandon even your most cherished notions, but also to find out the interesting places of experience, the data of enlightenment. Now, when you can get experiences, really beautiful experiences, then this, together with your rational thinking, can get you some really nice understandings about the nature of life, such as like reincarnation. Okay, you might reject it just because your experience hasn't gone that far. But who knows, maybe you can extend your experience. So we've got these beautiful little trainings, these experiments which you can do to meditate and see if you can remember your past life, who you were before. And I've described how that's done. It's not that difficult a thing to do, to go on a nice meditation retreat, get your mind very still. Because there's something about that still mind. You know what your ordinary mind is? You tell it to do something, it just doesn't do it. A still mind, the Buddha called it malleable, workable. You can tell it something to do something, and it does it straight away. A still mind is like a well-trained dog. It's not really like a dog, but that's the best simile I've got. So you tell the dog, go and pick up the newspaper. And the dog runs around, picks up the newspaper, wags its tails, and brings it back to you. Bring my slippers. The dog goes and gets your slippers for you. That's what a well-trained dog is like. And when your mind is still, it becomes like this incredibly well-trained thing. So you just tell your mind, go and get my past life. And it goes off there and gets your past life, comes back and wags. How about this one? No, I don't like that one. Goes off and gets another past life. Now, that's not such a joke, because that's basically what happens. In deep meditation, you ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And these things come back at you. So you get personal experience of these things. This is what we mean by investigation, not just belief because it says so, because your guru says so. This is not a guru tradition. Please don't believe what Ajahn Brahm says. Don't even believe what I've just told you. Not to believe me. But we investigate. We'll give it a try. See what happens. And when people do that, yeah, they do get these experiences back. And they can even check them out to see whether they are true or not. Because we've got records these days. They might get sort of this, like, past life experience. And it may have been sort of, say, in sort of New Zealand or somewhere as a sheep farmer. You go there and check the records, see whether there was any sheep farmer by that name. And it's amazing when you can actually check it out and it's true. There's many, many books which you can get. You know, and these are books written by, you know, really good people authentic people, people you can trust and believe. They're not just some weirdos. You can check it out, and yeah, it's actually true. And it does actually make things very, very interesting, that it explains a lot about, say, your character and who you are. One of the stories which comes to mind, you know, was of those people who have spontaneous memories of past lives. And because I grew up in England, some of you may remember this, if you also were my age and grew up in that country some years ago, there was an entertainer, a comedian called Roy Hudd. I don't know if that name rings a bell for any of you. Roy Hudd, he was a TV star, not a great star, but you know, he's pretty well known in my years. And he wrote this article that he got lost in the one-way system of London one evening after, you know, doing some sort of show somewhere. He got lost, went down a street he'd never gone down before, and the hairs on the back of his head started going up as all these memories of when he lived in that street in his previous life came up. Just the sight of that street. And because, remember, like a city like London, the buildings don't change that much. You know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, they're pretty much the same. So the memories were jogged, and he saw this was the street he lived in his previous life. Now, you may also know, those of you who have visited places like London, they have this tradition. If there's any well-known person that's lived in a building, they put these blue circular signs on the house. You know, like Sir Alexander Fleming lived here. Winston Churchill grew up here. Or, you know, the Duke of Wellington sort of, you know, went to this pub. Or whatever it was. But they put these blue signs everywhere. There's a blue sign on that house because he was a reasonably well-known person in his previous life. His name in his previous life was Dan Leno, who was one of the most famous music hall entertainers, sort of in the Edwardian era of London, maybe about 100 years ago, 90 years ago now. And the interesting thing was, he remembered this street, he remembered exactly who he was, the memory just came flooding back, he knocked on the door of the house where he lived before, and because he was reasonably well known, the people who answered the door recognized him. "Roy Hudd, what are you doing here?" And then he said, "I used to live here," and he took them around what was once his house. Now, what was fascinating for me, that he was a comedian in this life, and he was a comedian in his previous life, as if the characteristics had actually gone from one life to another life. Now, look at me. I must have been a stand-up comedian in my previous life. But I tell jokes in this part. I don't know. But, well, it does explain a lot about people's characters and their sort of inclinations. Because that's, you know, what karma is all about. The characters, the inclinations, the way you move from one life to another. And you do carry some of those things across. It does explain a lot of things. So we want to investigate to find out whether it's true or not, because it's important to find out. Instead of just believing and just taking a chance, yeah, no, there's no such thing exists, or yes, it does exist. As a Buddhist, we want to find out, investigate. But the investigation doesn't just go with things like, you know, reincarnation. It goes with, you know, even just the idea of religion or spirituality, to come to a place like this and question, to listen. If you don't like, go out, and that's fine. I always say there's no entrance fee in these talks. I often thought to raise money, no entrance fee, but an exit fee to go out. There's no entrance fee or exit fees. It's all like, come and see. And that type of come and see, if you like it, fine. Ask the questions, investigate, find out if it really makes sense or not. And of course, one of the most important things which we try and investigate, the meaning of life, the big question. So instead of just going philosophizing about the meaning of life, I want to investigate. What do you mean by the meaning? A meaning is like the goal of life, the purpose of life. And that's probably one of the biggest things we should investigate. What are we here for? Why is this life? And this is actually wanting to get a bit more data, first of all. You may have heard me say a little quote during the meditation. that just wanting something stops you enjoying what you already have. That's why we have this beautiful holiday called Christmas and New Year, a time when we stop working. Hopefully you stop traveling, unless you're Ajahn Brahm, who's always traveling. But so you stay where you are with what you've got. That's why we call it a holiday. You enjoy what you have rather than seeking something more. And you find the reason why we call this a holiday, why it is truly holy, because when you stop seeking things, you stop working in the most profound meaning of that term. When you stop craving for something more, then you really can enjoy, appreciate, and be grateful for what you have. You develop this wonderful quality we call contentment, being happy to be here with what you have. Because that's what we have to do on Christmas. The shops are closed. You can't buy anything anyway. So you're stuck with what you have. What a beautiful thing that is. Just to stop this great journey of life and just pause and appreciate how far you've come, where you are, and how much you already have. You have enough. Enough to be peaceful. Enough to be content. It's a wonderful thing to know that. To know that your wife, she may be not the most beautiful, but she is good enough. Your husband, he may not be the richest, the smartest, but he is good enough. Your house may not be the biggest mansion, but it is good enough. And you like it because it's yours, it's cozy, it's where you live. Look at me, my cave. Because I travel around a lot, I just love coming back to my cave. It's the smallest house in the whole of Perth, about 3 meters circular and about 3 meters high, like a little dome where I live. I'm sure that it could be in the Guinness Book of Records, especially West Australia, the smallest house anybody's got in this whole state. But it's cozy. I love it in there. I'm so content with my cave. I don't want to put on an extension. I don't want to. So that sense of contentment, you find that at last I found the meaning of life. It was here all the time, but I kept on looking for something else. So sometimes you might think you just would like to go and swap your wife for something more beautiful. Or get rid of this husband, you know, I've had enough of him, and get someone more exciting. But all of those types of ideas, you find that even the very wanting stops you being happy. It gives you more business to do in life. And aren't you busy enough? How much more do people want? And in the end, we have little experiences, times of contentment, moments of peace in our life. And they're one of the most valuable spiritual experiences. The times you have really felt content. When you're just at home, maybe with your husband, with your kids, with your dog or whatever, in your monastery, in your cave. And you realize, in this moment, I don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world. But I have enough. And you have these great moments of contentment. Where there's no craving, no striving, no wanting. You look around you, at least for a minute, 5 minutes, whole day, who knows. You're completely happy. What a wonderful moment they are. And they are not that rare. You do have them every now and again. But when you do have them, linger there as long as you can and value them. And you realize from your own investigation of just the beauty of that state, the freedom of that state, you investigate and understand some great meaning of life. We do go on a journey, but you know you've already reached the destination and you've forgotten about it, so you just go looking for somewhere else to go. You're already here. So why don't stop and enjoy where you are? And you'll find you have all the riches in the world. So what we should really be investigating, this present moment, the silence, the contempt, just being here. And there you find this inner peace. You don't have to go traveling all over the world to find it. The investigation gets you to the deepest of the Dhammas, the beautiful peace of mind. So, this is Christmas time. May all beings be at peace. So, how about you being at peace? Yeah, you're going to have Christmas time and there'll be things which don't go as expected. But why do we expect things anyway? You investigate all this expecting and worrying about things which stop you being peaceful. Like, I've just got so many responsibilities these days. I just, you know, list some of the things which I have to do. You know, just people just ringing me up from Victoria, ringing me up about their families, ringing about, I'm the free counsellor, and especially this time, one of the reasons I like to go to Malaysia, because people have holidays and they'd ring me up all the time with their family problems, at Christmas time especially. So I could just go and nick off to Malaysia and have a nice quiet time there. But, not just that, I've got so many responsibilities and so many duties to be done. Just, you know, building a 4.5 million retreat centre, or worrying about what I'm going to talk about tonight. Now, just tomorrow I go to Singapore, get off the aircraft, a couple of hours at Singapore. I've got to give a talk in Singapore, then go back on the aircraft and go to Malaysia and give a talk in the evening. So, what am I going to talk about? I haven't got a clue. And I don't care at all. I don't worry. Because I've investigated worries. Every time I've worried about something, it doesn't really work anyway. Whatever I thought was going to go wrong never goes wrong. It's something else goes wrong, not the one I planned. And all, you know, sometimes you've had plan A, plan B, plan C. But, you know, everything goes wrong. You go through the whole alphabet and you run out of plans. So isn't it wonderful, actually, just to learning, investigating, why do you worry? What is worry anyway? What worry is, you're just so afraid of making a mistake and things going wrong. That you think, you assume that if you think hard enough, you'll be able to protect the security of your future. When you investigate that, look, it doesn't matter what goes wrong. Life is what goes wrong. That's the nature of life. It's going to go wrong anyway, so don't worry about it. Just enjoy it when it happens. Because it, actually, things going wrong anyway. Again, I mentioned earlier about the idea of wrong. It's not things going wrong. It's just unexpected that life is impossible to predict. Even though we like all these fortune tellers, and you have these horoscopes, it's the new year soon. You're probably going to look at your horoscope. What is 2009 going to be? Is the stock market going to go up or is the stock market going to go down? All these horoscopes, a complete waste of time. I remember this one guy who comes every Monday to our monastery in Serpentine. It was my birthday one day. It was about 10 years ago now. And he read out my horoscope that day, because in the newspapers, if it's your birthday, they have a special horoscope just for that day. And the horoscope, he read it out, and he said, anyone born on August the 7th, that's my birthday, about 10 years ago, that this year will be a good year for romance. That's what it said. It was wrong. I'm still a monk. So much for horoscopes. So all these sort of predictions. One thing, you cannot predict anything. You don't know what's going to happen next. So why worry about it? Because the world is just so unexpected. And all the worries about what's going to happen next, what might happen, just... The world, actually the future, is that which you did not predict, which you did not see coming. So why worry about something which you can't see? You don't know what's going to happen. In fact, all the worry just takes you away from enjoying this moment. Now, just going back to one of the great stories in my book, Open the Door of Your Heart. I better finish this soon because I'm going over and Santa Claus is coming. One of the great stories from my book is about the drinking tea when there's no way out, I think it was called, about this fellow school teacher who who taught me when I was a school teacher. He taught me about just why we should not worry. Now, this is a life experience, not from Buddhist texts. He was a British soldier in Second World War in Burma with a few other soldiers on a patrol in the jungle. This is real war, real bullets. The Japanese enemy, if they didn't shoot you, they'd put you in a very difficult concentration camp. So he was very, very scared. He found this one afternoon, ordinary patrol, they'd stumbled into a huge number of Japanese soldiers. Soon they were vastly outnumbered, completely surrounded. This is one of the big problems of life. They're in a big mess. So what do you do when you're in a big mess? He thought he was a man. He was a soldier. Let's do the tough thing. He thought he'd try and shoot his way out. Let's go and fight. Who knows? One of us might make it. If we don't make it, at least he thought, we can take some of the enemy with us into death. He wanted to try and fight his way out. But the captain, the one in charge, says, no, we will not try and fight our way out. Instead, we will all sit down and have a cup of tea. It was the British Army, after all. And the fellow thought, the captain is crazy. He's been out in the sun too long. How can you think of having a cup of tea when you're surrounded by enemy soldiers, heavily outnumbered, at war, Second World War? But orders were orders. They had to have that cup of tea. He thought it was the craziest, the maddest thing he'd ever done in his whole life. But while they were having that tea, Scout came back, whispered into the captain's ear. The captain got all the soldiers together. The enemy's moved, said the captain. We can crawl out. Put your things away quickly. Move silently. And of course, they all escaped. That was brilliant of that captain. He saved that man's life. And my fellow school teacher said he had cancer sometime later, untreatable. Terminal cancer. He was like surrounded by the enemy for a second time, with no way out. What did he do? Try and fight his way through? No, just have a cup of tea. Relax, enjoy himself. Make peace. Why worry when there's no way out? So he learned, when life is like that, there's enemy all around you, you're about to die or something worse. Sit down and have a cup of tea, coffee, noodles, whatever you like. And wait. Why worry? Because the future is just totally unexpected. We don't know what's going to happen next week, next year, impossible. So instead, we enjoy the moment. When there is something to do, and then we worry about doing it, we do it right then. But worrying about the future, if you really investigate it, we waste so much time. And we also waste so much happiness by worrying about things which we can't really do much about. So when we investigate life, this is just another example. You see that instead of just thinking, yeah, worry is normal, why? Why worry? Investigate it. Find some other ways of dealing with life. When we investigate like that, we find a far better meaning of life. Because questioning, investigating, challenging, is actually destroying all these sacred cows, is actually the way to wisdom, to understanding, to freedom. This is why Buddhism has always taught freedom through the power of investigation, using your experiences, challenging everything with wisdom, with courage, based on the experience of life and seeing things in a deeper, more meaningful way. And you know it's wise, because it leads to the sense of freedom. Problems of life just vanish when you investigate and find the truth of things. Sickness isn't wrong. There's no need to worry. You have enough. Isn't it wonderful to realize you're already rich, beyond your wildest imagination, which is why you can't believe it. That's the talk for this evening about investigating. Okay, is there any questions before we finish off this evening? Yes. Yep. I agree with you. Just the differences are hardly worth worrying about, except when you have to go to the toilet, then you have to know which one to go into. But the reason is that the mind, when you actually go into meditation, you understand the mind is just, the mind of a male, the mind of a female, I'm not talking about the real mind, is exactly the same as in an animal even. So this thing we call the citta, the mind, when you get into deep meditation, come face to face, that hasn't got any gender whatsoever. That's beyond gender. And that's what becomes enlightened. That's what a Buddha is. So really, for the Buddha, the enlightened mind, that's not male, that is not female. That's why Buddha can be in any gender. That's why you know that in Thailand there's three genders. It's wonderful actually to know that when I became a monk in Thailand. I learned Thai. Male, female, and monks, nuns. We are the third gender in front of you over here. That's why we have our own toilet. Monks. Okay, I think that's, thank you for that question. And hopefully you enjoyed the talk and hopefully you can question it and don't just accept it because I said it. And gives you some more information, some more encouragement to actually to question everything in life, but based on experience.